Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein, and I'd like to welcome back a guest co-host, Carol Ripley Moffitt from the University of North Carolina. Welcome, Carol.
Thank you, Adam.
You know, Carol, we've got a fascinating show today. We're going to be having some incredible research that matters, but we'll also be talking with Dr. Peter Rizzolo, author and retired professor of family medicine at the University of North Carolina, about his new book, Judging Laura, a new novel that addresses the aftermath of sexual assault. And we'll also have on representatives from the Orange County Rape Crisis Center. This is such an important and fascinating conversation.
And who knew family docs could be novelists?
We'll find out. Actually, Dr. Rizzolo is a repeat novelist. We had him on the show a couple years ago
about
his first novel.
Right. Well, I wasn't here for that.
So. Exciting. Let's talk about exciting research that matters first, including let's jump right in to this first article about combination medications, using more than one medication for patients with attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, a disease that affects so many of our listeners and our listeners' families.
And this study was published in August. It's right off, hot off the press in the Journal of the American Academy of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry. And it reports on three studies and the results of combining two standard medications and that potentially can lead to greater clinical improvements.
Yeah, this particular one study was really looking at a sample of children and adolescents 7 to 14 years of age, those who had and those who did not have ADHD, and then looked at, well, what happens if you have one medication, both medications, on clinical and cognitive outcomes. And what they were looking at is including EEG or brain activity. And this was 8 weeks of the treatment, one or the other medication or the combination. And just what did they find, Carol?
Well, they found some good clinical response. And in fact, the response went up from 62-63% with the single drug therapy to over 75% with the combined therapy. That means that there were some cognitive improvement, cognitive functioning improvement, working memory improvement.
Yeah, and this is the plus side. And so the authors are suggesting that perhaps this combination therapy should certainly be considered for some children. And we've known that in the past that not all – one size doesn't fit all
exactly.
Here. But we should remember this was only 8 weeks, and it is adding in a second medication, which even though they say the side effects were similar, this was not a large study. So we would expect some side effects to go up. I think the news is if you're not getting a really good clinical response – with one medication, that's when one might consider something like this.
And realizing that the two drugs they combined have two different functions, so maybe they were complementary with each other
right.
In the way that they were effective. The stimulant
right.
Plus the mood stabilizer.
Right, methylphenidate, the stimulant, and guanfacine, or the mood stimulant. Well, let's talk about our very next research that matters, something I think that, boy, there's no downside for it. It causes potentially less overall cardiac problems. And which drug are we talking about, Carol?
Oh, the one my husband's allergic to, tree nuts.
Oh, no.
Yes. But peanuts, I noticed, are also in this. This is a study of 5,000 people who found that when they included nuts, tree nuts, and peanuts in their diet, they were able to reduce the biomarkers of inflammation, which are the leading cause for heart disease and cardiometabolic disease.
Right. The inflammation type of markers they were looking at in the blood, one was called C-reactive protein, another was tumor necrosis factor, interleukin 6, big terms mm-hmm. for inflammation. We know inflammation is linked to all kinds of cardiac diseases, even brain diseases like mm-hmm. Alzheimer's, we believe they're up there. And there was significant reduction here. And boy, this suggested that these nuts have certain properties in them, and whether it's the vitamins or whether it's the antioxidants. Who knows yet fully what's the combination that seems to protect against inflammation? But boy, this is one more piece of research that I think is good for people.
And just a note, there was 5 servings per day for people who didn't have a lot of already consumption of red meat, and then just replacing 3 times a week with servings of red meat and processed meat, eggs, and refined grain. So that both of those had significant reductions.
And let's do make sure that you aren't allergic to nuts.
Yes, exactly.
Like your husband.
Or maybe just eat more peanuts.
Whatever can work there. Let's talk about our very next research that matters. And we go kind of from one end of the spectrum as people perhaps are older, though nuts could be for any age that is allergic, to the very youngest, the preterm infants, and talking about breastfeeding in preterm infants, research that was published in the Journal of Pediatrics. What's this about, Carol?
These are babies who were born before 30 weeks gestation, and they were enrolled in a study, a cohort from 2001 to 2003. They tried to determine the number of days that the infants received breast milk, and you know, this is a really this is a challenging thing, Adam, when your baby is in the hospital in the neonatal unit, you're having to go about at least some semblance of your life. It's hard to keep breastfeeding in situations like that, not to mention the stress of having a preterm baby.
Yeah, even with a regular term baby, you've had a grandchild in not too distant past, and I bet it's not so easy even in a regular term
exactly,
baby.
Exactly, especially preterm first baby. Children, breastfeeding takes getting used to.
And for these infants, they receive breast milk as more than 50% of their total nutritional intake for the first month of life. And what they found by age 7 is that the mothers who were able to do that with the support that they were able to get had less days really of illness. They had more health impacts that were positive, such
better
as
brain
cognitive
development.
Brain development, cognitive, reading, math, attention, and even motor testing at age 7. Now, this is not necessarily cause and effect. This wasn't a randomized.
Right.
You couldn't do
this. This was
that.
Observational, so.
It could be a problem like selection bias, which we say that, you know, the mothers who chose to breastfeed perhaps had more social support, had better self-motivation, other things that could have led to it. Now, they try to control for these things. So it doesn't seem like there was a downside to encouraging it. What do you think?
I think it should be encouraged as much as possible, and especially for these results with the children at long term, 7 years.
And we may have to adjust some of our health systems to really be much more supportive of women, particularly
exactly.
These preterm babies. Not an easy thing to do, as you
exactly.
said, but very worthwhile. Talking about last research that matters, Carol, it's kind of a little bit of a whimsical, but I think it's kind of fascinating, and I think we wanted to bring it to our listeners. But it's a type of bacteria that inhabits the human nose, and this bacteria produces actually an antibiotic. And the name of the bacteria, we'll try to say it together, see if we can say it right.
Staphylococcus
lugdunensis. We'll call it Staph
Lug. Yes, this is a German study too. So,
And we didn't say the name right, but this was actually published in the journal Nature, a very prominent journal, and it begins to look at actually things that perhaps prevent those resistant bacteria, the methicillin resistant staph. Perhaps from being in the nose is when you have this good staphylococcus, the staph lugs, as we call it, being there. And I'm not sure that we know what to do with this yet. I mean, it's not like we can promote it or perhaps have medications that can promote this to help get rid of perhaps people's carrying of the bad bug.
Well, I think the novel part of this is that normally antibiotics are formed only by soil bacteria and fungi. So the notion that it could be in the human body, these antibodies, that's the novel piece of this research.
And maybe by taking antibiotics pills, it may actually alter the function of this one that actually produces something protective. So I think we'll hear more about this, and we wanted you all to hear more about that. That'll conclude the Research Matters portion of our show. We're going to take a short break. When we return, Carol and I'll be talking with author Dr. Peter Rizlo and representatives of the Orange County Rape Crisis Center about a new novel, Judging Laura, that addresses the aftermath of sexual assault. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Carol Ripley Moffitt. We'll be right back.
Mm-hmm.
UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Carol Ripley Moffitt. Today on Conversations, Carol, we're talking with Dr. Peter Rizzolo, author and retired professor and friend of family medicine at the University of North Carolina, and Natalie Zimba, the crisis response coordinator, the Orange County Rape Crisis Center, about a new novel that Dr. Rizzolo wrote and Ms. Zimba's thoughts about it and the issue that addresses the aftermath of sexual assault. Welcome, Dr. Rizzolo and Natalie.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Let's just start one with you, Dr. Rizzolo. And I almost have to call you Peter. I've known you for so long, and I must tell our listeners, Peter is one of the first people I met when I became a family physician in North Carolina and the valued family physician at the University of North Carolina. But this is not your first novel. So tell us how you became, again, an author and just how you got interested in making that quick transition from being a physician to being a noted author.
Well, it wasn't exactly a quick transition. When I was in third year high school, I wrote a one-act play that got put on in class because it was the best one. And I thought, hey, this is pretty easy. But I really never thought of writing as a career. I wanted to be a doctor. And it wasn't until I was getting ready to retire that I decided post-retiring I wanted to write. And I started writing my first novel while I was still in active family practice. And in this particular novel, I actually started after I retired about 10 years ago.
So it's finished after a decade. Would you be willing to read us an excerpt from this novel called Judging Laura?
I'd be happy to. The section that I'm going to read is very short. It occurs 8 years after a sexual assault. A sense of impending disaster and sleepless nights preceded Laura's second visit with Dr. Corbett. How would Bruce react if she could never have a child? Would the events of that awful night cast a spell over their entire marriage? I'm terribly, terribly sorry to tell you this, Laura. Dr. Corbett removed her glasses and slowly polished the lenses with a tissue. Both your fallopian tubes are badly scarred and cystic. I suspect one of those boys must have given you a sexually transmitted disease. Disease? What kind of disease? Laura asked. The changes in your internal organs are consistent with untreated gonorrhea. Women are often asymptomatic or have minimal symptoms. The word gonorrhea struck Laura like a blow to her chest. She realized how stupid she had been not to see a doctor after the party. She took slow, deep breaths to calm herself. Would the disease have damaged my tubes if I'd gotten treated? Early treatment would almost certainly have prevented the damage, but you mustn't blame yourself. You were young, frightened, confused. Is it too late for treatment? Laura interrupted. There's no active infection at this time, so there's no need for antibiotics. The natural history of untreated gonorrheal infection is spontaneous resolution after a few weeks or months. But of course, by then, I'm sorry to say it, I've already damaged your reproductive organs. I dread having to tell Bruce that I had a venereal disease, Laura thought. How can I? She began to cry. Dr. Corbett came from behind her desk. She sat beside her, placed her hand on her arm, and handed her a tissue. What about babies? Laura asked after she blew her nose. There's nothing wrong with your uterus, but with closed-off fallopian tubes, you'll never be able to have babies the way nature meant. Fortunately, you have other options. In vitro fertilization, for example.
Wow. Wow. That's really powerful, and I think it's a springboard into lots of so many issues here. Mm-hmm. And I guess I just want to, you know, Natalie, you are a crisis response coordinator at the Orange County Rape Crisis Center. As you hear a novel, tell us what you do, and then how does that novel resonate with what happens on your day-to-day life?
Sure. So I work as the crisis response coordinator at the Orange County Rape Crisis Center, and a big part of my job involves supervising and training all of our hotline volunteers, who are the folks who answer the helpline 24 hours a day and provide information, support, and referrals to callers who are looking for services and support and what to do after something like this happens to them. It's interesting to me to see this novel, to know that there are conversations happening about this issue, because it's hard for people to talk about when it impacts them personally. So to take the conversation to a public level and see it represented more in kind of mainstream media, it's heartening to me to know that we are having these conversations and that people are paying attention to this. And specifically the story that is depicted in Judging Laura about the medical implications and the legal recourse in seeking civil action against a perpetrator, it's one of many things that could happen after someone experiences sexual assault.
Well, I'm struck, and maybe you are too, Carol, by this notion of guilt. And I wonder just from both your perspectives, from the clients you see, Nellie, but Dr. Rizlo, from the character, talk about guilt after experiencing sexual trauma.
Absolutely. Laura, when right after the trauma, she felt so guilty. She didn't want to go near a doctor or an emergency room. She didn't want anybody to touch her. She felt she was partially to blame. And her mother reinforced that guilt when she showed up at home by questioning her behavior. She said, "I smell alcohol on your breath. You've shamed the family. You're damaged goods." And Laura was devastated. Her own mother didn't come to her defense. And that was also reinforced by her classmates. They didn't know how to react. They shunned her. She feared that the boy who was responsible, she would run into him any time in school. He was a predator. She just was terrified. And she finally dropped out of school midway through her senior year in college. I mean, high school.
Mm-hmm. Guilt is actually a very common response we see in these situations. And it's kind of a way of trying to take back control over an entirely uncontrollable situation. What happens is entirely beyond a person's control. And if they can identify guilt, identify some kind of behavior or action that they have done personally to cause this to happen, then they can claim some sense of agency and reestablish their authority and their own boundaries.
Yeah. And, you know, just as you described what she was going through, that sense of helplessness, hopelessness, who is going to hear, who's going to understand. Trying to fix the situation as a secondary survivor, as someone who's hearing the story, that either we don't know what to do so we avoid, or we try to fix, and that both of those are so detrimental to the mm-hmm. person who's been victimized and in this situation, keeping them in that role of victim rather than giving them the empowerment that they need. Can you tell us a little bit more about what you recommend that people do when they are hearing a story like this, or mm-hmm. Someone who's a secondary survivor who wants to support and help?
Right. Empowerment. You definitely hit the nail on the head there. We very much believe in the empowerment model at the Orange County Rape Crisis Center. And what we really try to emphasize in that is that the survivor, the primary survivor, knows their own experience best, and they have all the skills and all the tools and all the support that they need to make their best decisions. So the best thing that a secondary survivor can do is just sit there, be present, listen, do whatever you can do to support them in any way, but not to make their own decisions, not to make decisions for them, give them back control over their own life.
Well, we're going to need to take a short break, but I think this idea of judging, and obviously our author here, Dr. Peter Rizlo, and his new novel, Judging Laura, is something that we really want to follow up on and really delve into. But we will take a short break, and when we return, we'll continue our conversation. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Gulson and Carol Ripley Moffitt. Stay with us.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Carol Ripley Moffitt. We've been talking with Dr. Peter Rislow, author and retired professor of family medicine at the University of North Carolina, and Natalie Zimba, the crisis response coordinator at the Orange County Rape Crisis Center, about a new novel that Dr. Rislow wrote called Judging Lauren, that addresses the aftermath of sexual assault. Dr. Rislow, as I read your novel and think about it, this is highly personal. Any subject, I think, that an author uses as a subject of a novel you spend years writing has to be. And for me, and many listeners, it is personal. I've known so many people, so many patients, so many family members who've been affected by sexual violence. It is pervasive.
Where does the hope come in here?
Well, for Laura, I think she learned to live with the fact that she didn't report the rape, and that in the book, she doesn't even contact her mother for a year, and when she does, she finds her mother had died. And so she has great remorse and guilt about that. But the only time that she decided to go back and seek justice was when she learned that she no longer could have children because of a disease she contracted. And the problem with it is that there are no witnesses to rape. And to prove that somebody is guilty beyond a reasonable doubt, that's an extremely high bar. And she knew this. She's a very intelligent young woman. And she knew that if she went to court and she lost, that she would be judged. People will often blame the woman, especially if he comes off free.
Natalie, I wonder in your role in the Orange County Rape Crisis Center, we know that spouse support, friends, and family as a survivor seeks justice are really critical, and you provide guidance to these secondary survivors. Tell us a little bit more about how does that work? What are the challenges?
There are many, many challenges. And what we do mostly at OCRCC is we provide information and we can provide referrals and get people connected to good resources and supports. And we very much leave it up to the survivor themselves as to how they want to move forward and what they want to do. So when working with survivors and working with secondaries, we just try to provide what insight we can about how the process works and what different options are available to someone, and they can pick what fits best for their experience. So things like seeking medical attention or deciding not to seek medical attention, filing a report with the police or not filing a report with the police. There are all kinds of considerations that go into that in terms of what are their support networks like. If they decide to press charges, are their family and friends going to support them through this process? Do they have the financial resources to pursue something? And just general life considerations of what they are capable of doing at that time and what their limits might be.
And it must be very difficult. I think it is for all of us in helping professions not to really want to help in some way. And so how do you deal with someone who just doesn't feel like they are ready, just like Laura, who don't feel comfortable coming forward and seeking help?
What first comes to mind is that we give people permission to feel that way. Because a lot of times we see a lot of pressure, particularly from secondary survivors, like, oh, you really need to go see this doctor. You really need to talk to the police about this. But maybe that survivor just doesn't feel ready to do that yet. And so we validate that that is a real experience for them and that it's perfectly okay for them to feel that way. And we let them know that those services are available and that there could be benefits to seeking medical attention immediately or filing a report with the police sooner, but that it's entirely up to them if they want to do that.
And I imagine that what you do most of all is provide a safe space and a safe place.
Yes.
So what a gift.
Yes. We very much strive to do so.
And I know, and maybe we can link on our website, that in hopefully most communities, at least across the United States, have access to at least services for support like the Orange County Rape Crisis Center does locally within Orange County and neighboring counties, but this a local resource, and hope we can do that. I want to ask you a question, Dr. Rislow. You know, you're a male physician, and here it is that you're writing about an issue of sexual violence and a survivor and a female. Do you feel that there is an educational role within the medical profession? And what would it be like, if you thought about it? I'm sure you probably have, if this were kind of reading for medical students coming up, because it, to me, sometimes perhaps men don't have quite as much of a sensitivity. We hope it's getting better. I suspect it is. But I would think both male and female medical students. Is that a vision of yours?
Absolutely. Some of the sequela of sexual assault include depression, panic attacks, insomnia. And doctors are seeing women or any other patients also for those symptoms. And I think they need to be aware of that in taking a history, that it may be a little bit sensitive to go into that, but they really ought to consider gently asking, have you had any experiences in the past that you think any inappropriate approaches by anybody, that sort of thing. I don't know that the medical student's going to say, have you ever been raped? But they may approach it in a delicate way.
And tell me, how are Laura's providers? What were they like, and how does Laura maybe help educate those providers or bring them along, or does she?
Well, her main provider was her gynecologist. And in fact, she, in a way, encouraged Laura to proceed because Laura thought, it's been 8 years, there's no way. And she said, well, maybe there is a way. Maybe we can make those boys pay. And that's perhaps a little bit of science fiction, because as of now, nobody has recovered DNA from a woman's internal organs. But in my reading, I know that there are reasons to believe that that may be possible. We know that bacteria and viruses live in our body for many, many years, and they have DNA. And some of the diseases we get, like trichinosis, occur because those organisms then become active. So maybe it's a possibility. Maybe we'll get some researchers looking into it.
Well, you're extending what's possible.
Yes, and yeah. It's time for us to say thank you for being here. But Natalie, is there any one last thought that you would leave with us?
The thing that I would want to leave is just to let people know that our hotline is available 24/7. They can always, anybody, primary survivors, secondary survivors, if it's a day later, if it's a year later, 10 years later, they can give us a call anytime. Our helpline number is 919-967-7273.
And is there a national hotline? Because we have listeners all over the United States and internationally. How do people find something that's there?
Yes. So off the top of my head, I don't remember the hotline number, but RAIN is the national organization, and they have a hotline, and they also have a feature on their website where you can go and look up local resources.
And Dr. Rizlo, anything that's lurking next that you want to give us a heads up on? You're now becoming a prolific, well-known writer, and we want to congratulate you. But what's any last words?
Within a year, I hope to publish my fourth novel. It's about a medical intern. Something I know a little bit about, who goes up against hospital bureaucracy, and he wins and loses. It was a lot of fun to write, and it's about spousal abuse and the way he handled it.
Well, we actually look forward to reading, hearing, perhaps having you back again if you're willing. We'd love to. We want to thank both you, Dr. Peter Rizlo and Natalie Zimba, for sharing your time, your expertise, and the hope that you bring to listeners locally and around the globe who need to hear your message.
Thank you very much for having us.
Thank you for having us.
We're going to take a short break, but coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Carol Ripley Moffitt. We'll be right back.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Car segment of our show today, Carol, we get to spend a few minutes talking about our listeners' health questions and concerns. Pretty cool, huh?
We are ready.
Well, we'd like to know if any of our listeners want to contribute their own question. They can send their comments to yourhealth@unc.edu. That's, again, yourhealth@unc.edu. And we'd like to ask our great executive producer, Laura Lacey, to read us our very first house call question today about the difference between HDL and LDL.
I went to the doctor recently for a yearly exam. She called a week later to tell me that my good cholesterol was high, but that was good news. But it got me wondering if your good cholesterol can ever be too high.
Well, that's the difference between HDL, or the high-density lipoprotein, which is what people call the good cholesterol, and the LDL, or the low-density lipoprotein that people call the bad cholesterol. Carol, I'm sure you've heard about both.
Typically, you look at a combination, right? Is the total numbers is one thing you look at?
Yeah, you like to sometimes see what's the ratio of one to the other. And you like that ratio to be, you know, 2 to 1 or less, that HDL to be as high as it can, and that LDL to be as low as it can. And those are, really important aspects. You know, can the HDL be too high? Well, I don't, I've not heard that. We'll take a look at that and see. But it's really a function of what makes that HDL be higher. And certainly some people genetically can have higher HDL. Some people have, by exercise, it raises the HDL. And then some people actually through some of the medications, if they're on medications, that can indirectly affect the HDL. So lots of reasons why there. But usually for most people, it's a protective factor that's something to be good about mm-hmm. and to try to promote. So thank you for the question and appreciate it. Laura, what's our very next question?
I've started on a couple of new medications this year. I've also gained about 15 pounds. I have a feeling the medication is behind the weight gain, but I can't stop taking the pills I'm on. Is there a way to better control my weight while I'm on them?
I think the first thing to do is talk with your doctor about the medications. Maybe even see if there's some, even though you can't come off the medications, are there some that would do something similar without the weight gain side effects? So that would be the first thing I would explore.
Yeah, I think that's a really good question. And, you know, which medications can actually, cause you to gain weight? And it turns out there are quite a few, including some common ones that are given for depression. Which can cause people to eat more. There's one called Remeron. That's a common one. Other medicines that are used for both depression and psychosis. A lot of these medicines we use for schizophrenia have indirect mm-hmm. effects of causing weight gain. But, you know, as our listener and questioners ask, they don't want to get off that. So I do think it's a combination of a caloric restriction and really working with the nutritionist and maybe a weight coach at the same time that you're on these medicines, because some of the things that may cause increased eating from these medicines, increased appetite, may be helpful to be cured with things like drinking more water and increasing physical activity. Mm-hmm. Any other tips, Carol?
Well, no, I think you've hit the three main ones, water and activity and reducing caloric intake under the guidance of a nutritionist, preferably.
Laura, what's our very next house call?
I'm a woman in my late 20s, and I have mild to moderate scoliosis. The doctors who've treated me say that it shouldn't progress anymore and that treatment isn't necessary. Sometimes, though, I have lower back pain. What can I do to manage any pain that does occur and prevent it from getting worse as I age?
As the mother of a physical therapist, I will put in a plug for strengthening the core muscles around your back so that they support your back, and potentially that could decrease your pain.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of questions here. Folks with scoliosis, as well as a lot of other things that lead to structural problems with the back, people who have arthritis, people who've injured their backs, for the most part, are going to have some chronic pain from altered either mechanics or altered anatomy or the muscles and the nerves, lots of different ways of understanding that and lots of different ways of perhaps treating. I know chiropractics. I don't know if you've ever been a chiropractic. I've been. They'll think about some structural things, and I think that has a role for some people. But I also think those exercises, you know, I've had some low back pain from playing tennis way too long and doing one of those unnatural Djokovic serves, I wish. Mm-hmm. But you know how you really develop this kind of back thing in a lot of athletes. And doing 5 minutes of exercises, it doesn't make it go away, but it controls it.
Right, right. Well, it strengthens that whole area, so you're not likely to have an, like you said, stretching it out of place as will be less risk for that.
Yeah. So I think the biggest thing here is to recognize that you can manage it for the most part, presuming the scoliosis doesn't get worse. Mm-hmm. I'm seeing a physical therapist. If you need to go to a spine center and really work with them, this really involves a lot of patient education, strengthening, and recognize that it may flare from time to time. Yeah. Thanks for the question. What's our very last house call?
In the past, I've had episodes of white coat hypertension, but my doctor wondered if we should look further to see if the readings the doctor's office takes are more correct than the readings I take at home, which are usually pretty good. A 24-hour blood pressure monitor showed that I tend to have high blood pressure not only during the day, but also even while sleeping. I know I was anxious during the day because I had the monitor on, but I don't see how I would have been anxious when asleep. Should I be concerned?
Well, that's a complicated but a really good question. I guess, you know, Carol, do you ever – I mean, when I go to the doctor, I send them like, oh, no, they're going to take my blood pressure and it's going to be high. Does that happen to you at all?
Oh, no, huh? I always have great blood pressure.
You're just like – but do you ever worry when they take your blood pressure? Or are you just like, no, it's going to be good?
It's going to be good.
Yeah, mine actually usually turns out good, but I think because my father, bless his memory, had high blood pressure, I sometimes worry mm-hmm. when I go in there, you know, this is going to be that time. And I know that affects some people, you know, quite a bit. And I can imagine the thought of having my blood pressure done even at home is likely to make me a little bit anxious. And I wonder every time that, you know, machine goes off, that certainly could do that. But I think here we raise a really good question that says, well, it wasn't just elevated during the daytime, which could be more like that white coat high blood pressure, that blood pressure that's elevated when you kind of are in front of people. But in this particular case, it's elevated while they're sleeping, when it should actually be going down.
Right, right.
Doesn't that intrinsically say, ding, ding, ding?
Sleep apnea?
Sleep apnea is a really good question. And we wonder whether or not someone could be overweight. Oh. That certainly would be one of the first things that should be looked at, particularly in terms of treatable things. Because what this doesn't say is, well, what needs to be done? Because, I mean, if the blood pressure is elevated, you're absolutely right. Weight loss, and you're now helping run a program that's really focusing on weight loss. This might be a potentially good candidate for that.
Right.
You know, and I guess the last question I have is how severe is it? And is there time for doing changes? But what there isn't time for probably is ignoring the results here, because you have more data. And I'm a big fan of more data is better. And so you gather data here. Mm-hmm. And you act on it. I know, Carol, when you run the nicotine dependence program, you collect carbon monoxide data. Mm-hmm. If you had a carbon monoxide level 5 to 6 times above normal, you would act on it, right? Otherwise, why collect the data?
I know that that's a person who probably will need some support from medications. But and I guess the same could be said here, that might be something, a conversation with the doctor about, are there some medications that at least would give you, if you redid that test on the medications, would it show improvement?
A significant reduction.
Yeah.
Great idea. Well, that'll conclude our house calls today, and we want to thank everyone for joining us for Your Health. We hope you've addressed issues and concerns important to you, and you can share your own stories at yourhealth@unc.edu. You can visit us online at yourhealthradio.org or follow us on Twitter, Facebook, iTunes, or our health app. Just search Your Health, one word, for a free download. I'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship. I want to thank my guest co-host, Carol Ripley Moffitt, and our guests today, Dr. Peter Rislow and Natalie Zimbo. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health. On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Carol Ripley Moffitt.
And we'll see you again next week. Bye-bye.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine.